It's Wednesday, December 14th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a look at a travel story in this weekend's Los Angeles Times that has some questioning the paper's fairness in its reporting on Japanese internment camps. A reporter from The Blaze takes heat after tweeting a picture firing shots at ISIS. And I want to ask Mike and Ernest about a piece that was in the Washington Post this past weekend about a generational shift. Children living their lives before the camera, looking for likes and thumbs up on YouTube. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but...
Now, let's get down to business.
Next month, The Celebrity Apprentice will return to NBC with Arnold Schwarzenegger sitting at the head of the table. He'll be firing and hiring. Let's take a close look at the credits, though, and we're going to see that Donald Trump is listed as one of the show's executive producers, keeping a hand in its ongoing production. Some have said that this is a tradition, a nod to the show's creator for the legacy that he leaves behind. Others say it's a way for him to keep making money off of that show. What's your take?
Is it a potential conflict of interest? Sure. Is it a story that we need to be focusing so much of our fire on right now? No, I'm just saying, here we go again. We're spending all this time with Trump jerking our chain, Kellyanne Conway jerking our chain. We spend a lot of time on that story rather than on other more substantive things involving who is going to be in his cabinet, what his policies are going to be, that sort of thing.
No, I agree. I mean, to me, it's just one of those, here we are again. I mean, it's a continuation of what was going on in the campaign. And these little bitty stories that take away time from the real substance of what's going on is his cabinet picks, the ongoing issue with Russia and whether or not the Russians were involved in the election by hacking into the DNC and other campaigns. I mean, that's the stories that we need to be talking about and not this.
I mean, I think it would be true if Donald Trump really and truly was going to be spending a lot of brain power, you know, offering insights and talking points or whatever to the producers of the show, because he is listed as an executive producer. Kellyanne Conway got in a few ha-has. Well, President Obama plays golf. Why can't President Trump, in his off time, executive produce a TV show? He's not going to be doing that. He's going to be getting money because he and Mark Burnett started the show, and he was the star of the show for a long time. He's not going to put any time in on it.
Yeah, one of the things that really fascinates me about this is the fact that, okay, you have this show coming out, you have Arnold Schwarzenegger on the show, but what about those people who connect the president to the show, who don't really like the president, don't like his policies? What kind of an impact is that going to have on NBC as a brand? That's going to be the interesting part to me. Is I think if I was NBC, I'd be more concerned about that than I am about whether or not Donald Trump is the executive producer.
I suppose, again, that it's possible that the president could direct advertising or attention or ratings toward NBC in some positive way because his show is airing there and he might make a few dollars here and there on it. I think the more likely thing is the concern. I mean, not that it will happen, but the more likely concern would be that NBC might somehow go easy on Trump in news coverage. But I mean, come on, look what happened the last time that NBC News was slow to run a major story that they got their hands on first, right? The Access Hollywood tape.
Right.
It got leaked, the story was published, and it just made NBC look bad.
Okay, well, Trump TV. During the campaign, we talked about the possibilities that President-elect Trump was in this to start his own media empire. It kind of made sense. I mean, think about what we were discussing with his issues with Celebrity Apprentice. But what if I were to tell you that as President of the United States, he will have control over an entire network on radio and on television, a network designed to spread pro-American messages around the globe, that being the Voice of America?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a story on our Link blog that goes into this in more detail, but tucked into a defense spending bill was basically this little bitty clause that eliminates the board, the bipartisan board that has been running and operating the Voices of America, and they're going to have some sort of CEO now who is appointed by the president to run the Voice of America. And what both Democrats and Republicans are concerned about is that this CEO could be, you know, who's going to be be picked by the president could also be involved in pushing propaganda that's more Trump-like, or especially with Steve Bannon, who's coming from Breitbart, who's really interested in this, and this is his background, could insert someone in there that could start doing that kind of thing. That's a huge concern that both, like I said, Democrats and Republicans are concerned about, and the fact that now, under this law, that Voices of America programming can now be seen in the U.S., which used to be illegal.
I think this is a more legitimate story than the last one we just talked about, but I also think it might be one of these stories of unintended consequences. Yep. There's this board of governors that directs what happens with Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, etc. And a lot of people, including President Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have been critical of that board and said there needs to be a CEO-type person because the programming on Voice of America has been perceived by some folks as not sufficiently robust or pro-American or serving the interests of our foreign policy as it should. Well, now that Donald Trump is going to be president instead of Hillary Clinton, it's quite possible that the White House and Clinton are not going to be happy with this change being made. On the other hand, I'm not sure how easy it would be for Steve Bannon or the president himself to have the kind of impact immediately on VOA that they think they're going to. There are a lot of dedicated, professional journalists that work at all of those sister properties. And I don't think they're just going to roll over to a CEO and say that we're suddenly going to be doing blatant propaganda just because this person comes in and says that's the way it should be.
No, I agree with you there. I think there's the potential for long-term damage here by going to this model because you don't have that check and balances there when you had four members who are Republican appointees and four members who are Democratic appointees on this board of governors. So you don't have that bipartisanship there. You have this one CEO who is being, you know, appointed by the president to do this. So it may not be Trump, but it could be Trump's predecessors or two or three presidents down the line where you begin to see this sort of propaganda creep into the Voice of America as you begin to have these transitions.
Well, and Mike, you talk about saying, you know, there are hardcore journalists who are there who we think we can trust to hold the ideals of our profession. But I also kind of look at RT is an example, Russia Today, and the idea that there are strong journalists who are working there too who have been shown the door or walked out when being asked to do things that they don't feel meet their journalistic ethics or standards.
Right. I don't say that that's not likely to, that could happen. I think the bigger problem was something that Ernest touched on a little bit ago, and that's the fact that now the Voice of America's programming can be directed at Americans here in the U.S., not just citizens of other countries. And I don't know that anybody's going to tune in to Voice of America instead of their favorite news program, but what if Voice of America were to start to do things like some of these other brand studios do and send content, video news releases, if you'd like, to traditional news organizations, and they start running these propaganda pieces or pro-U.S. pieces without labeling them as such.
What was it? Maybe 2000, help refresh my memory, maybe 2003, 2004, 2005, that video news releases were all the rage. I know I was a television producer in Chicago at the time, and I fell into the trap, and then we started having some serious discussions about, you know, these tapes that would show up from pharmaceutical companies that would know we were hard-pressed to get good health reporting and hand those along. And there did become a strong backlash in newsrooms against using that content.
Yeah, but that content is still out there. You still see it every day in local television news, especially in small markets. So, I mean, this would be another avenue for that type of journalism to go out there that the public doesn't really understand. This is being backed by this particular corporation or in this case, by Voice of America being backed by the government.
And back in the years you mentioned, most television news operations were pretty flush with cash.
Yeah.
That's less true now, and it's going to be even less true next year and the years ahead.
Which may change motivations. We've been talking a lot about the reporting and the journalistic aspects of the Trump presidency, but one thing we haven't talked too much about, the business side of the media industry and what that might look like. Mike, you brought this up to me and wanted to talk about some of these pretty large developments that have happened in the past few days.
Well, and here is a serious overlap between the interests of media owners and the president-elect and the Republican Party. So what's going on is that there's these rules that the FCC adopted back in the Nixon years, 41 years ago, these cross-ownership rules that prevented one company from owning a television station and a newspaper in the same media market. There were a few that were grandfathered in. You worked at one in Chicago.
Yes, I did.
But there were very few of those, right? And the whole idea was that if you had this conglomeration of media under one or a few owners, then you'd have fewer, less diverse voices in the community being reflected. Well, back during the heyday of cable TV and as the internet was coming along in the late 90s, broadcasters and publishers started pushing back. And they tried in the early 2000s. The FCC even did change its rules until federal courts overturned them. There hasn't been much action for a while, but now that President Trump has been elected, publishers of traditional mainstream news organizations, television station owners, networks are pushing really hard to get those rules overturned again. And President Trump's going to have an opportunity to appoint one or more members of the FCC that could do just that.
Yeah, I think the part of this is, you know, you have those newspaper entities that are looking for a way to really push their digital content or to engage in that and to fight back against Google and Facebook and others who are basically aggregators and distributors. But the newspaper entities aren't getting back profit-wise, what's going on in terms of Google, in terms of Facebook, and then the other thing is that, you know, they can get some tax breaks for their print product, but as we all know, print is not drawing as much as it used to, but they can't get any tax breaks for the digital operations that they're putting in, and the investment that they're putting in digital, they can't get a tax break on that. So that's another issue that they're hoping to push with the Trump administration.
And I have to say, I sympathize with the argument or the philosophy that people who produce mainstream news, the kind of fact-checked news that we think is really important these days, they should have the opportunity to compete fairly against the Facebooks and the Googles and all the other folks that are out there. Unfortunately, corporate media has not shown that when given the opportunity to do the right thing, that they necessarily are going to do the right thing.
Well, I mean, you just said it. I mean, it is a corporation. And that's one of the things that came up in this election is that the public is very distrustful of corporations, the media being one of them, to do the right thing when they're given a break, either on taxes or on regulations or whatever. And here's another example of that, okay? If Trump allows this to take place, if he goes along with what they're asking for here, are they going to be good stewards of news and information that the public wants and needs in order to operate in a democracy? And the jury is out on that. And I don't think it's going to come back with a very good verdict.
Well, maybe we could kind of read some of those tea leaves at the end of last week when Senate Republicans went home without reconfirming, and I hope I say her name right, Jessica Rosenworcel, as chairman of the SEC.
She's a commissioner of the FCC, and with her gone means the next person that's going to be appointed is going to be someone that President Trump wants appointed, not someone President Obama does. The likelihood is then that the balance is going to shift so that there will be a majority of Republican appointees on the FCC. And if that happens, that's when things like the cross-ownership rules can change, the tax policies could change, net neutrality could change. Let's get away from newspapers and television for a moment.
And that was a huge issue during most of President Obama's presidency, and we never really got to that where are we going to be in terms of net neutrality, and a lot of it was because he couldn't get his FCC commissioners appointed.
But essentially what has happened, I mean, so it could get overturned. Net neutrality is essentially meaning that internet service providers can't charge you as individual subscribers and then also go to the program providers and charge them to give them better access, faster bandwidths, all of that cost getting passed on to consumers too. Business-friendly Trump administration and FCC might say, we don't need to do that
anymore.
True.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. What comes to mind when I say Teen Vogue? Clothes, makeup, celebrity gossip, biting political commentary. That's right. Teen Vogue wrote an airtight op-ed outlining the ways that Donald Trump is using gaslighting techniques to fool the American public. First, let's go ahead and explain what gaslighting is.
Well, it's based on some like 18th century story, apparently, about a husband who was doing things to drive his wife crazy by taking away items in the household or something when she was asleep, and then claiming, hey, what did you do with whatever it was? And the only way she knew that, you know, she wasn't living in this bizarro world was that every time something would go missing, right after he turned down the gas light, the lighting in their home. So supposedly what's going on is that Teen Vogue says that President elect Trump is basically trying to convince the public and convince the media that maybe they're just a little crazy. They don't know what's going on. They don't know what to trust.
They don't know what to trust in terms of what he's saying. It's because he'll say one thing and then he'll do another. Mm-hmm. And you know, one day he's okay with the Chinese and the next day he's embracing Taiwan, you know, those kinds of things. So it's real interesting that this came out in Teen Vogue, yeah. But... okay. If you go back and you look at some of the articles that they were writing during the campaign, they had a steady diet of this along with the clothing articles or the...
Selena Gomez's makeup.
Exactly, the makeup article and all of that. So you would see this and basically what the editors and publishers of Teen Vogue are saying is that teens are interested in this information. This is where they get most of their news and information. So we're gonna also sprinkle in politics, government, social activism, those types of things within here because this is what they're talking about in their own circles. So let's provide them with some of that information in our magazine.
I mean, if you think about it, Teen Vogue's target audience, they're going to be during the Trump years trying to make it to college.
Registering to vote.
Trying to vote, starting their own business or their career or their family or whatever. So what's going to happen with this administration is going to matter a whole lot to them. And the thing that I found interesting, and I guess I have to plead guilty about this, you posted a link mm-hmm. to a piece from Jezebel, which mm-hmm. said, the only people who seem surprised these days that Teen Vogue is doing serious mm-hmm. journalists are older white male media commentators. And I have to plead guilty. I had no idea they were doing this kind of reporting.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to just say, I'd seen a couple of these articles during the election, and I just got the articles, and I really didn't pay much attention to where they were coming from until like right before the election I saw. Actually, I take it back, right after the election I saw an article. And went, whoa, that was in Teen Vogue. And it really sort of surprised me. But what I really like about them is that they are straight and they're to the point and they're understandable and they connect with not just that generation, but with across generations.
Exactly. So I want to ask you this, Ernest, because we talk a lot about the need to teach media literacy. That has been a theme we've talked about for months. This seems like a shining beacon of hope here. We're looking at preteen and teenage girls pretty much being exposed to this kind of journalism where maybe we didn't think that might have been happening before.
Well, I mean, I think this is an opening. It mm-hmm. provides an opening to do that kind of literacy where you're actually saying, hey, you can get all the fluff pieces, mm-hmm. but you can also get this as well in a media environment that fits in with a certain demographic. Now, if you can do that across demographics, then you're teaching media, you're teaching a part of media literacy where they understand, yes, this is a puff piece about makeup, but then you also have some serious journalism being done here about serious topics.
By the way, could I say, if you're going to read this article, mm-hmm. there's a link embedded in this article that takes you to a communications professor from a small college in Massachusetts where she has a list or basically how to tell whether something is misleading, false, clickbaity, yep. or satirical. And it's really a good list of how you can tell by looking at the site address or by the headlines or whatever, whether you're getting legitimate news or not. So I'd suggest people look at that.
Okay. Well, when I was a student here, Greeley Kyle taught my broadcast reporting class, and he was adamant that we never make ourselves part of the story, that we tell other people's stories. It's not about us. Anyone who has ever sat through one of Ernest's cross-cultural journalism lectures can hear that him say that over and over again in their heads. Well, apparently, Jason Boutrell, didn't get the memo. He's been recalled and suspended after posting a photo to Twitter that shows him firing shots at ISIS fighters. And then the site ran a story that it billed as exclusive talking about that. This researcher, this reporter, he is a Marine veteran, but that doesn't mean that this incident still didn't put the lives of other service members at risk.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. It's not about you.
I knew I was going to get to hear it. It drives me crazy.
I mean, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, what were you thinking? But I think part of it is that he moved from being in the military and being into journalism with, as far as I could see, without getting the proper ethical training about this is what you can and cannot do as a journalist. You should not, unless you are under fire yourself or you're saving someone else, you should not pick up a weapon in a combat zone. You don't do it to show your gusto or whatever you want to call it. It just makes no sense to me. So when I saw that photo, I was like, what was he thinking? And then my next reaction was he was thinking about, I'm a Marine and not a journalist.
Well, everything you say is true. And the biggest problem is not so much that he was jeopardizing other soldiers, which is true. He is jeopardizing journalists all over the world. I mean, we already know that terrorist groups and others are less likely to say, oh, you got press written on your clothing or your vehicle. Okay, we understand your role. We're not going to take shots at you or kidnap you. This is just making the division between the press and active combat soldiers less clear.
And what makes it even worse is that the organization he was working for took it and ran it as a story and celebrated it to get clicks. I don't know why they would think that was okay. I mean, you're putting him in danger. You're putting the troops that he was with in danger. You're putting other journalists in danger, all because, you know, you're trying to get people to read your article.
And you think you look cool.
Very tiny, you know, bit of positive news is that the managing editor of The Blaze, once it was pointed out, hey, this was a stupid thing to do, he did issue a public apology, which didn't sound like excuse making. It sounded like, I screwed up and we'll not do that next time.
Okay, well, this year we're marking the 100th anniversary of the National Park System. And with that, we're seeing a lot of feature stories about different parks, their history, and the ways that people can enjoy them. There was one of those such stories late last month in the Los Angeles Times, taking readers inside Tule Lake, a rural community in Northern California, just south of the Oregon state line. During World War II, it was one of the largest and most notorious of the Japanese internment camps. The Tule Lake War Relocation Center was the only one of the 10 camps to also have a stockade and a jail. And at its peak, there were 19,000 people who were housed there. Over the weekend, the paper published two letters to the editor from readers who were upset about that story, saying that it was unbalanced and glossed over the real reason for the internment of Japanese Americans. The story itself, not so much the problem, the idea that the LA Times decided to publish letters from people who were saying Japanese internment was done with good reason.
Well, I mean, I have a problem with the letters.
Okay.
But to be honest with you, I'm not surprised, because if you go back and you just over the last couple of years, in comment sections under stories that are posted online, letters to the editor that you see this kind of thing about all sorts of really incredible instances of the U.S. not living up to the democratic ideals and people rationalizing why it was that way. And this is an example of that. I think newspapers and media organizations in general need to be careful about how they do this. You don't want to stifle people's First Amendment rights, especially if you're opening up your newspaper to comments and letters. But you also need to just as much as you do that, you need to be critical of what those people are saying and what they're thinking, and you need to educate them about, wait a minute, there are other factors here that are in opposition to the way in which you're putting in your comments or the comments that you're putting in.
So the original story ran, as I recall, in the travel section of the LA
Times,
And I suspect that the travel editor maybe didn't catch just how incendiary those letters were going to be compared to, say, if it ran in more of the straight news pages or political section or whatever. That doesn't mean that the comments shouldn't have been flagged. I mean, they did play on racial stereotypes. They weren't factual in terms of the history. But I think what's really kind of interesting here is that the fact that they did, apparently, if you believe the Times after the fact, ran by mistake, shouldn't have run, they did generate a conversation in the pushback that probably is much greater than the original story.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that. They did generate that sort of conversation. But I think you could have got that conversation anyway if you ran those letters and then ran some type of information that refuted what the comments were that were in the letters that were flat out inaccurate.
Okay. Well, before we go, I want to talk about a piece from this weekend's Washington Post about kids who are 7, 8, and 9 years old living out their entire lives, in their words, for the audience. They spend a lot of their time watching other kids' videos posted on YouTube and then want to create and post videos of themselves doing everyday things like trick-or-treating, unboxing new toys, getting ready for school. One child in the story is quoted as saying he'd rather watch videos of other kids playing the video game Minecraft than actually playing the game himself. A kid would rather watch other people play video games than play the game itself. We've got a whole... This is like way beyond the put down the video games, go outside and play. I don't know. I want to put a question to you that is actually in the headline of the story. You can see it on our Links blog. What happens to childhood when every moment of childhood is recorded and shared?
First of all, I think every moment of childhood was recorded and shared, most kids and most families would be worse off for it. I do think, however, there's this sort of notion that somehow kids should see what they do outdoors or in interacting with real people as the real world and all this internet stuff is the virtual world. I think most kids, and I think probably a lot of our students today who are 20-somethings think it's all real, okay? So the problem is, how do you as parents try to manage what happens with your profile online? I mean, I have a grandson who's 5 months old. Now, he's not posting videos to YouTube, but every time his parents point their iPhone in his direction, he looks in the lens. And I really think it's going to become instinctual at some point that kids just see this as a regular part of growing up.
Well, I think we're already there. I mean, if you watch, just sit down in, you know, a cafe or whatever and just watch people with their phones. I mean, it used to be that most people are on their phones and they're texting or whatever, but now they're texting, they're taking pictures, they're taking videos. Every time somebody, I mean, think about it. When anytime something happens, the first thing people do is pick up their phones and start videotaping. And now we've gotten into that era where everything is open and subject to being on video. And this is the, as Mike was just saying, this is their reality. This is the real world. You see something, you videotape it. You record it. You put it up on YouTube. You put it on your Facebook page. I mean, this is where we are right now.
I mean, I do think it's interesting that young people are more interested in, quote, authentic folks on YouTube or whatever, as long as they're authentic. There was a 4-year-old in this story, whose family's making $1 million because he's doing, quote, toy demos for toy companies.
Yeah, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. We're going to be taking a couple of weeks off, but we'll be back with you on January 4th. Until then, we'd like to give our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Thank you. We'll see you in a few weeks.